Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2015. Lecture 26, delivered on April 30, 2015. The title of this lecture is Review for the Final Exam.
Today, review for the final exam. The final exam is structured like the two midterm exams. There are three parts. Part one is multiple choice. Part two is workout problems, and part three is short essay answers. As far as part one goes, there will be 30 questions. It's a 200 point, of course, but that's just for points purposes. Each one is worth 3 points, 30 of them. And then part two, a number of questions, some of them have separate parts, so it's kind of doesn't mean much to tell you how many there are. And then part three, you answer 5 of 7 of the short answers. Part one, to begin, many of the questions, more than half, probably almost three-fourths, are I copy and paste from the two midterms. Find the ones that you missed that I know I will get you on again if you haven't studied. Ones that are important to the core principles of the course. In part one, of course, I'm going to obviously ask you some things about the Fed, for example, structure of the Fed. That would be easy questions. Obviously, I will also ask you questions about things like money, M1, M2, all that kind of stuff. I will also ask you questions. Everything on that exam, first part, you've seen the multiple choice kinds of questions before. Studying exams one and two is going to be one of your best ways to get prepped for it because they're all from those two exams, either directly or something that is related to what I've already asked you. Something, for example, about bonds, about different kinds of bonds, what it means to be below par, above par. Probably ask you a few numerical types of questions, like a net present value question, like I did on the one exam. Ask you about, I really should just put it up on the screen for you to see. That would probably be the easiest way to do this. Make sure you know about risk, diversifiable versus non-diversifiable, what beta is measuring and what it's not measuring. Know about capital markets versus money markets, primary versus secondary markets. Risk, the structure of risk, maturity, default, and illiquidity premia. Risk-free rate, what's in that? Know the names of the different formulas, like what, which one, if you saw a formula, would that be the capital asset pricing model? Would that be the price of a share, the cost of component cost of capital for new equity? Would that be the expected market premium of above risk-free? You saw that on the first exam. There was one question that listed a whole bunch of different little formulas. I said, which one is the capital asset pricing model or something like that? Know those formulas, what their names are. Just make sure you have that down. Make sure you know about different kinds of taxes, flat, proportional, progressive, and regressive. Know how to price a treasury bill. I think we did that either the first or second lecture, how you can get the price of a treasury bill. Just remember to, it's the interest, dollar interest over the price you paid for it. Going back to the Fed, just make sure you know about open market operations. If the Fed is adding liquidity, that means that they're buying bonds, which causes demand to go up, price to go up, yield to go down. It's very important. Make sure you know that relationship between price and yield. They're inversely related. Make sure you keep that. You might want to get that as a tattoo. Tasteful. You know, left hip.
Yep.
Okay, good. Just want to make sure you're not going to get it someplace really ugly. Know the different types of offerings, firm commitment, best efforts, self-underwriting. Know the different terms in offerings like tombstone, red herring, prospectus. Let me try a couple here. Can you give me a couple of different ways that a company could go public? Forms?
Form S-10?
No.
IPO?
You were close. Stop. Stop. You're beginning to lose. You were there, and then, you know, think, not Form S-10, Form S-1, yes. S-1, then there's Form SB-1, SB-2 for small business offerings. And then there's that one that's not a registration. It's an exemption from registration that makes freely tradable stock. That is a?
Reg D-504.
Oh, I love it when you talk like that. That's exactly right, yes. Let me loosen my tie. Yeah. Okay. You, sir? Some of the exemptions where you don't have to register the stock, but it's not freely tradable. It's restricted under Rule 144. Can you give me a couple of exemptions from registration?
Would that be Reg A?
Reg A, which is also very cool music. Bob Marley, he did some real good Reg A.
505.
Reg D 505 and 506. Reg D 506. Keep the Reg D in there. It makes you sound like a professional. You know, if you go to a finance singles bar and you say, a 505, please, neat. Yes, you are. Because how else are you ever, ever going to find a mate? Even there, it's going to be tough. But if you say Reg D 505, they know what you're talking about, and you will be able to find a life partner. Or at least one for the night. Know those kinds of exemptions. And if I am a public corporation and I have one of the directors of the corporation has just been arrested for embezzlement, how would I quickly inform the public of that through the SEC?
For 8K.
K, 8K. Not okay, K, form 8K. Okay? No, 8K. Yeah, 8K. Form 8K is for non-recurring events. Every year, a public corporation must file form... No, that's the quarterlies. The annuals are the 10Ks. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, so know those kinds of basic terms because they go beyond just finance, and you as... educated and self-informing investors can go to the SEC and look at those forms yourself and see what's going on with these different kinds of non-recurring events for 8Ks or for the annual financial statements for 10Ks. Oh, excuse me. Now, make sure you know those. Those are quick multiple choice kinds of questions that I can pop up on you from time to time. Know the component cost of capital. What is cheap? What would be a cheap component cost of capital? What would be an expensive component cost of capital? So tell me this. after-tax cost of debt. You, sir, after-tax cost of debt, would cheap or expensive capital?
Cheaper.
Unless you've got a pile of it, and then they're going to whack you at the bank. But, okay, let's try this one. New equity, cheap or expensive capital? Very expensive. It's your worst. It is the butt beater because you are buying new friends. You know how much it costs to buy new friends?
A lot.
Except in Decatur. There are a couple parking lots. Oh, sorry. No, I'm sorry. I didn't, you know, that wasn't your mom there in that parking lot. I am so going to go to hell. Okay, preferred stock. Cheap or expensive? This one's a tricky one at first, but think about it. As an investor, are you at great risk with preferred stock, or are you not at such great risk? Go ahead, say what's on your mind. You were shaking your head. Yeah, it's cheap because, you see, preferred stock is equity, which is always riskier. But because preferred shareholders have a stated dividend, it's right there on their certificate. You are going to get 1.2% of the par value of the stock. You know how much it is, and if it's cumulative preferred, they can't give out a dividend to the common shareholders unless they have made all payments on dividends to you first. So it's relatively safe, and safe means low risk, and low risk means low expected good. Bingo. Good God, this is actually working. It always does, and that always mystifies me considering who your professor is. Okay. I'm trying to think. I'm giving you an overview, but at the same time, the questions are the ones that so much of it is what you've seen on the exams, the two exams. The exams are where I test you on the goals, the objectives, I should say, for the course along the way, what we call the modular objectives. And then at the final, I just want to see if you've got those objectives established and satisfied to get a great grade in the course, or at least a passing grade so that you can get out of this finance stuff. Okay, part two. I will put up a narrative Sunday night. It will have two parts, it will address two different problems on the final exam. Remember on exam one, I put up financial statements. Well, you'll get financial statements as one of the two narratives. They will be the financial statements of an S&P 500 company, a consumer products company, a retailer, to give you a little bit more detail. It's a company that is relatively easy to handle. It's got a couple of odd little quirks in it. It's a place where some of you have shopped, not all of you. It's not you guys, not never there. And you're saying, just what's wrong with Walmart? No, it's not Walmart. Relatively straightforward company. Like I said, a few little twists, so don't get really weirded out if you get a number that's negative that usually you see as positive. Just follow the rules. I'll ask you the same things that I did on the exams before, some ratio questions off it. So it would probably do you good to bust your butt to get all the ratios done and changes in ratios. I know that's a pain in the butt, but it's also good exercise practice for the exam. That will be one of them. Now, the other of the two will be a question that is the same kind as was on your narrative for exam two. And that, of course, relates to a marginal cost of capital question. Now, for God's sake, don't send me an email. You didn't tell us what the questions were. You just gave us that story.
It's the same questions every time.
Yes, for God's sake. Just stay frosty. Get it done. Check your work. You've got 2 days to go through it again to make sure you didn't make a calculation mistake. And there you are. Now, on this exam, I will not ask you for business risk those coefficients of variation. I won't ask that on the final. And the reason is because too many of you make a little mistake and then it blows up in your face on that. And then I don't want to have to do the work of figuring out if the rest of your answers are right based upon the wrong answer that you got for your first answer. But anyway, so your narrative will be a set of financial statements, income statements, and balance sheets for an S&P 500 company, and then a question relating. And always my questions are actual companies. This one's one that I'd never used before, and it's actually a real company. Now, I changed the numbers somewhat and the ROIs, but this is an actual company. I'll give you a hint. It's an indie movie company that was considering four different movies to produce in a year. I changed the names of the movies, too. The names they chose really sucked. Then also, of course, I'm going to have you find price of a bond, yield to maturity of a bond, and yield to call of a bond. Now pay attention to whether I ask for the price or the quote for the bond. And don't put a dollar sign if it's just a quote. And remember, two decimal places. I would really love to not knock off any points for people not following the house rule there. That would be huge if I didn't have to worry about that. What else was I thinking? Something else about that. Oh, price of a share of stock, like on exam one. You have to use the capital asset pricing model to find the discount rate, and then use that discount rate when you're calculating the price of the stock. Nothing tough there. Remember, don't round until you're finished. Use, for two decimal places, use at least four decimal places in your calculations. There's actually a rule about how accurate you'll be based upon the accuracy of the results, intermediate results. But just as a rule of thumb for a class like this, don't round more than four decimal places in your intermediate calculations before getting to the end. And remember, always report to two decimal places for me. Even if your answer is 2%, give me 2.00%. I'll have you find DOL, DFL, and DCL, like I did on exam two. Those are awfully easy to find. Don't screw up and use the wrong number for calculating one. If you don't do that, then you're probably going to get the right answer. You're going to get it right. I'm going to do one of those. They're almost like no-brainers. On the first exam, I had on that quiz where I give you some information, financial information, and you have to put together a quickie little income statement. What was gross income? What was operating income? What was income before taxes? What was net income? But that, of course, means that you're going to have to calculate the tax. You'll have the tax tables like you did on the exam. It'll be pretty much the same question with just different numbers. Again, I'm not throwing any curveballs at you. This is a straight-up pitch down the middle of the plate. Obviously, I'm also going to want you to be able to calculate a loan payment and an effective yield. And somewhere you're going to have to find a net present value like you did on exam two and an internal rate of return. That is pretty much... I'm not saying I've covered everything on the part two or on part one. I'm not going to hand you the candy store, but that's a pretty good survey of what I've got for you on the final exam. Nothing new. You've done everything before, and here's your chance to impress the hell out of me by nailing it to the wall on the final. which a lot of you do. You are amazed by how close you are to becoming finance professionals, or not. One way or the other. Part three. The bad part first. No mercy on your complete one sentence, spelling everything right, proper grammar. No mercy on that. Just give it to me like you actually are professionals out there who write as college graduates. From there, you answer five of seven questions. At least four of the questions, and I believe actually four of the questions, you've already seen them. They were already on exams, on exam one or two. The others were named as possible questions when I walked around and told you possible questions for exams one and two. So there's nothing out in left field for you. You've seen the questions. You know what I want out of you. Say what you have to say and be done with it. So if I say, what is the relationship between net present value and internal rate of return? You say the internal rate of return is the discount rate that sets net present value to zero. That's all you have to say. If I ask, what is money and what are the three types? Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange. And the three types are barter, commodity, and fiat. That's all you have to say. Don't go five times around the barn to get to the outhouse, because you will probably get lost, and then the Sears catalog will have blown away, and then, anyway, whatever. Make sure on that section, just to give you the heads up, it is quite common for me to want you to show me that you understand risk, especially that you understand how we measure risk, but also that there are different kinds of risk. There is the systematic risk. What is the other name for systematic risk? Can you tell me? What is it?
Non-diversifiable.
It's in the system. It's not a nodule that I can take off you. It's a polyp in your colon, okay? That was just really out. No. Think of it some other way, okay? That's bad. Okay, this isn't just you got a cute little bolt through your nose. This is Satan has entered your bloodstream and you are saying, eat my dog, okay? This is the kind that you can't get rid of. And then the other kind is non-systematic risk, which is diversifiable. You can get rid of it. How do you get rid of it? Can you tell me that? Well, I picked on you enough. Woman, how do you get rid of diversifiable risk? Here's a hint. You diversify. You're looking at me like, duh. Yeah. You just buy different stocks so that they cancel out each other's noise and all that's left is the hum of the market. If I have something that in a well-diversified portfolio has no risk in it, can you tell me what measure I would use and what that number would be? What is our classic measure of risk for stocks and bonds?
Beta.
And if it has no risk in a fully diversified portfolio, what would its beta be?
One.
Okay.
Zero.
Okay. Zero. 0% volatility. The zero is actually 0%. One is 100%. Okay. What is the beta of the market portfolio? Can you tell me that? Remember, beta measures volatility of a well-diversified portfolio against the market portfolio. So what would you say would be the percent of volatility of the market portfolio against the volatility of the market portfolio? 100%. That's exactly right. A market beta, if you've got a portfolio and you want to mirror the market, you want to mirror the market, then you would form a portfolio that had a weighted average beta on the portfolio of 1.00. You would then own the market portfolio, basically. If you wanted to, okay, now suppose that you were a really wild and crazy person. You were a contrarian. Is it possible to go counter to the market? Can you construct a portfolio that runs counter to the market? Say yes.
Yes.
What would be the beta of that portfolio? Anyone got an idea? What would be the beta of a portfolio that runs contrary to the market? It would be less than zero. It would be negative because it would then be doing this against the market. So if you are one of those persistent pessimists, or if you're always what we call a contrarian, the term is contrarian. There are actually mutual funds that are contrarian mutual funds. They have slightly negative betas. Do you remember what I said was a kind of a stock that can show a slightly negative beta? Gold mine stocks. They tend to run counter to the market. They tend to have negative betas. Okay. Enough about that, though. Make sure you know for the essays, and this is true in other parts of this exam too, in part one, what I mean by prior claim and residual claim. What I mean by prior claim and residual claim. Now, as far as prior claim is concerned, madam, can you tell me who has prior claim to the cash flows of a corporation?
The people they're indebted to.
The debt holders. Yeah, the debt holders. Okay, and who has the residual claim?
Stockholders.
Oh, yeah. Who are the owners?
Yeah.
Okay, right. Okay, now, why is it that the debt holders have the prior claim? Why do they have the prior claim? Can you tell me that? Do you remember what I said? What can a stockholder do to you if you don't give that stockholder a dividend?
Just bitch at you.
Yeah, that's right. They can bitch at you. And you know what you do when people bitch at you?
Don't listen to them.
You're going to be good as a married man. Okay. Okay, what can the debt holders do to you? If you don't pay them, what will they do?
They can, like, come after you in court.
And do what?
Take all your assets.
Shut it down. Remember what I said? The debt holders can shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mama wear furry costumes that please them. Now, do you remember what kind I recommended as a starter kit?
I think it was, like, Fuzzy or
something. No, Mrs. Fox. You're thinking of Fozzie Bear. That would be for you as a starter kit. And Neckbeard over there, too. Real finance for real people. Now, if the company does have residual funds, if the company does have residual funds, after all of the obligations have been paid in a timely manner, what can they do with those residual funds? Hint, there are two things they can do with them. What are they?
Plow back,
reinvestment in the company.
Issue a dividend.
They can do a little of both. They can do all of one and none of the other. They can. Interestingly enough, I think I mentioned this, and this isn't on the final, but I do want to point out something. I didn't really grasp this until more recent years, that most companies are required to pay a dividend, to a dividend. And I'm not sure what the logic of our great government agencies are that regulate these kinds of things, but it's kind of a bizarre, you can't actually be a pure plowback company forever because there's something like recapture or retained earnings or some word like that. It's an accounting thing, and I usually switch off when they start talking accounting. Which reminds me, I will in some way, is probably in the essays, ask you about costs. What distinguishes costs in finance and economics from cost in accounting? Are they the same? Is one bigger than the other? And what is it that would make the one bigger than the other? You remember that on exam one. And I'll probably make the question more, show me really know this, you understand this. That even though we use accounting information, that is just a dark window through which we look before we get down to the serious stuff of asking the important questions. What are the real costs going on here? Opportunity costs, hidden costs, things like that. How much? Where? Who farted? Oh, not that question. We need to know things that the accountants can't tell us because they're not allowed to. That's not their job. We are information constituents of the accounting, but we are also information constituents of a larger world. That's why if you're a finance student, I take you places and I say, oh, you want to be an investment advisor, you want to analyze stocks, well, you're not going to get to sit at your computer your whole life. We're going to get your butts out there. We're going to look in the stores. We're going to talk to the insiders and the outsiders. We're going to ask questions. What are they not telling us in those financial statements that the accountants produce? And again, this is nothing against the accountants, but they are not the end of the story. And I will find a way to ask you that. Show me that you understand that, and you will make my heart warm and my pants damp. I swear. Your turn. Ask me what you will. Bring it on. Ask me a question. Anything. Go. Senior, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. No. That's what I want to hear. You know, tell me that. Ask me that. That's all I have for you today and forever. I thank you. Elvis has left the building.